Hello and welcome to Series 2 of The Joy of Writing. I'm your host, Mark Carew. In this series, I will be talking to authors about the fun, the satisfaction, the joy they get from their writing, whether it's prose fiction, narrative non-fiction, or poetry. My second guest in this series is Andy MacDonald, poet and director of the Gatehouse Press in Norwich. Andy's debut poetry collection, The Somnambulist Cookbook, was published in 2019 by Salt. Now, a somnambulist is a sleepwalker, and dreams is a definite theme, and is very well done, and a lot of fun in it as well. And it gives a sort of surreal happening to a lot of the poems. It reminded me of an episode of Green Wing, which I hope is a reaction you're all right with. How does that sort of reaction strike you from this particular reader?
I think that's really interesting. I mean, I think if we are on the path of a slight kind of English surrealism, and I say English only in the sense that I was born in Kent and I've grown, you know, grew up there and moved to Norfolk later. You know, I've never really lived in Wales, Scotland or Northern Ireland. But I think, you know, what struck me is this kind of pastoral and kind of urban edgeland dream spaces that seem to happen. And you know, I guess there's a lot of non-spaces in this book. So a hospital, you know, is a kind of ideal non-space. You know, it's a bit like hotels or anywhere else, but, you know, often with grimmer outcomes.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's a funny thing. I mean, on that, I couldn't get it into this collection, but I'd always been struck by this hospital used to be in Norwich in the city centre. Where they, you know, they moved it all to the outskirts. It was, you know, if I was sceptical, I might say it was a bit like kind of moving the poor out of the centre of Paris in the 19th century. Suddenly the ill and the sick and the dying and moved to the edge of the city. But what happened was they knocked down the tower blocks, and I was thinking about actually how in these hospital tower blocks, babies were born, and now it's just air where all these lives started. It's just there because the tower blocks have gone.
Yeah,
that didn't appear in this collection. I've not managed to kind of find a way to write that. But in that is this sense of, well, you know how it is as humans that we are not particularly good at dealing with loss. I don't necessarily mean on an emotional grief level. I mean in the sense that it can really discombobulate us, make us feel completely kind of at sea. And I find this with cities, particularly, where I might walk around the city and think, oh, I'll go to that place, and it's gone.
Yeah.
And actually, standing there is kind of this abortion of architecture that's kind of sprung up in its place, this kind of horrible kind of new build that hasn't got any architectural plan into it whatsoever. You know, in the sense that those places are kind of lost. I guess we might call that feeling evanescence. I guess this kind of struggle with loss and so on. So I think, you know, kind of my meandering way of what I'm trying to say here is that actually, you know, Green Wing is welcome. I mean, anything that... and actually, the fact is that, you know, you've picked up on the comedy here. You know, it's not a dreadfully po-faced collection. It is meant to be funny in places as well as dark, you know, and I hope the kind of notes in there came through as you were reading.
Well, I very much appreciated the humour because I saw that as a way of the poet reaching out a hand and saying, look, come on, this will be fun. Here's something for you here, and that's a very good way of connecting. I mean, I have, you know, read some other poetry which doesn't have a laugh in it at all, or anything to even, you know, make you smile. So when you get something that's genuinely funny, it's great. So, I mean, I'd like to give an example. Is some very droll humour. So in the title piece, which is about, I suppose, a sleepwalker walking through a city of dreams, speaking, you have a nice line. You've got, this is my double, here's a firm handshake and away with the ladies, tells a good anecdote at dinner. I mean, that just raises a smile. That's great. Another nice one was... he moves on and now he's looking at his double, which I thought was a very nice touch and a very, very much something that happens in a dream or a waking dream. You can look at yourself or someone like yourself and He has centred himself in my bed, pushes my daughter on the swing, feels embarrassed that we wear the same clothes. Very nice, very nice. And then the best one, or one that I really want to sort of slip into conversation and pretend I thought of it. He must remember that on the continent they sleep on the right.
Yes.
Which is really, it's, I mean, that does a you know, that really warms the reader up. So the humour was very good. You mentioned the poem that you haven't written yet. I mean, you'd like to. I wondered, in a collection of 28 poems, how do you decide which ones go in, and how do you decide the order?
Well, that's kind of difficult. I mean, when I first submitted this to Chris at Salt, it was probably double the length, and I knew it was going to have to be shaved down. But what I needed at that point was a publisher to say yes, we want this, and B, the editor at that house to say, and this is what you need to get rid of. And actually, that was quite surprising. So there were some poems that he said I should take out, and oddly, they're the ones that have been published before elsewhere. He didn't know this.
Okay.
They've been published in magazines, and the ones he kept or wanted me to keep was really interesting. And he was saying, let's boil it down to the kind of essence of what's there. And he said, we also need to start with a banger and end on a banger, basically.
Right.
So I kind of really was thinking about kind of the sucker punch of the first poem, and then, you know, the kind of the how to end the collection, really. So it just sort of starts to fit together. I mean, the Somnambulist Cookbook, the actual long poem sequence that's part of this, was something I wrote the first four stanzas in about 2006, 2007. And it just sat around, and I could feel there was something sort of nagging me, you know? And it wasn't until about 2015 that I started to write the rest, and it just came really quickly.
Right.
I understood exactly what it was. So, you know, some of these poems, therefore, have got a gestation of like 15 years probably.
Yeah.
And others are, you know, kind of arrived pretty much fully formed and are in there fully formed, you know. So it's an odd thing. I guess there was a thematic element at the heart of this book that was trying to find its way to pull the poems together.
Yeah.
And that was initially around a medical disorder called fugue states.
Right.
And fugue states, if no one's ever heard of these, are absolutely fascinating. So it's this kind of psychosocial disorder where you know, as an individual would completely forget who they are, maybe due to a blow to the head, maybe due to exceptional trauma. And they would completely believe they're someone else. The most recent case was a guy in America. There's a beautiful documentary on Channel 4 about a decade ago about this, where he ended up in Coney Island, completely lost, didn't know who he was, and only had a scrap of paper with a number on it.
Right.
And it took months and months to puzzle this out. But a woman had given his number to him in a bar, and then something had happened to him between leaving that bar and being on the subway, and he couldn't remember anything about his previous life. They sent videos to him. And there was pictures of all his friends. He said, well, they seem like nice people, but they don't seem my type of people.
Right.
And then they were kind of talking about his interest. He was really interested in arts, literature, and music. And his dad said before, you know, he was a stockbroker, had no interest in these things. He was really into sport. And suddenly, you know, he's a completely different guy. And that comes from a long way around. This comes from a book I first came across called Mad Travellers by Ian Hacking about fugue states. And I was really interested in the difference between the fugue state and the flaneur, this kind of dispassionate wanderer of Paris in the 19th century. And something about the fugue state seemed to really tap into my creative mind as something really fascinating, and about the kind of fragility of our identities and who we are.
Yeah, definitely.
In a way that dreams and reality overlap and really mess around with that, hence the bit that you enjoyed with the guy saying, you know, here's my double.
Yes.
Sense that there is this other that is somehow more perfect than you are, that can walk through life in this way, this kind
a
of
better version of you. Yeah,
it's like, you know, sort of, you know, Mark version 2 or Andy, you know, 2.0, And if only. Of course, you know, it is scary. You know, Edgar Allan Poe's story.
Well, they do say that your doppelganger's out there, your double's out there, maybe just on looks, but it would be interesting if there was more to it as that as well. Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, you do sort of tease and mess around with identity, and there are some sort of hallucinatory moments. That there's a piece where you or the main character comes home and then it's sort of a riff on Red Riding Hood and finds a dead wolf in bed in place of the daughter, and you know, very quickly we've changed register and now people have changed, and it all gets very, very interesting.
Well, you know, that's the other long poem in here, How to Take a Late Train Home.
Yes.
You know, if I have to get the train out of London back to Norwich, the last one's something like 10:30. And it seems to then just fold time into itself and become this journey that's unlike any other. And, you know, you're kind of in that kind of dimly lit carriages for what seems like an eternity. And you're trying to do that thing of, you know, not slipping off into sleep. So, you know, suddenly you might hear a voice halfway down the carriage and it's almost like a dead grandfather speaking to you, or you know, it's kind of really odd and discombobulating, to use that word again. So that came out of that, the sense that what if you lapse into the dream world and then come out of it in this kind of weird travel, this kind of, you know, this sense of unease that then creeps in when when you're desperate to get home, but it feels like it's taking eternity.
And again, it's about that division between wakefulness and dreaming, where strange things happen. I enjoyed that poem, I Had to Take a Late Train Home. I've sort of classified it under the theme of slice of life, because we all know what you mean when you're on the last train home. And there's a famous one from London Waterloo coming out our way, which you really want to avoid at all costs, but if you're on it, then you're slightly worried late at night, 12:30, 1:00, whatever. So you have lines like find a compartment of like-minded travellers, so you know so you know you're safe or something, or if you're a reader, herd with other books. It's all about safety and numbers in the same herd. A great line, if you prefer earphone bleed, find a blood bank. Yeah. which again is a nice slip into another sort of key, really, isn't it? And then it's the humour, only kidding, I told you not to dream of being on a train.
This is actually weirdly where I think probably where my prose overlaps my poetry. So, you know, this kind of second person address that happens in that poem is kind of instructional, but it's also really threatening, you know, which comes, you know, the day after listening to Dominic Cummings sort of in his vaguely weird kind of way of speaking and threatening and changing his blog halfway through the month. And then, you know, so this odd sense of this voice of authority, which actually shouldn't be an authority, which is challenging. And I kind of think the second person voice that's in that poem is something I like writing in prose, in the way that it challenges and, you know, gets the reader to question, you know, whose side is the narrator on here?
Yeah.
And I trust the narrator. Because we don't really think about narrators in poems in that sense. But it is a second person address. And that's something that happens in a few of them, you know, how to be dead in an English hotel, for example. Mm. You know, it's kind of like instructions on how to do things in a way that you'd hope never to be in the position of the person being addressed.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of sort of waking dreams? Is that where some of the raw material comes from, or is that just too simplistic a reading?
No, it does. I mean, I take a lot from dreams. I have very vivid, very vivid dreams. Mm-hmm. So, you know, last week I had this dream that I lost my father in 2017, but in the dream he was there and he was really angry and disappointed in me.
Right.
Because I'd been too busy on social media trying to talk about COVID-19. And he was disappointed because he said, what do you know about it?
Right.
And I woke the next day and I was just really kind of upset by this dream. I found it really disturbing. My father was so upset with me. And then I realised, you know, when I started to write about it, it was like, it's not him, it's a demon, you know, wearing his face. And it became this kind of quite fantastical thing. And in this, you know, I mean, the poem I'll quickly read it. I slept and woke to find someone beside me.
Yes, that's a good one.
It was an old colleague who had escaped the morgue. She was confused and thought I was her husband. And now she wanted me to lie down beside her on the bed. Her blouse, patterned with meadow flowers, glowed with sunlight flitting through her empty ribcage. She caught me staring. Look, she said, we're on holiday. Don't ruin things. Let's make the best of it. I held her. What else could I do? As I examined her hair and wondered if it still grew. As we listened to the wind whistle through her torso, she turned to her side, placed my hand upon her hollow breast and said, my love, can you hear the sea? Oh, that was a creepy dream.
Yeah, I bet.
And that was like, I can't turn that one down. That's got to go into the poem wholesale.
Do you have anything like a method of working with dream material?
The tip that I got, and I broke it with that poem, the tip that I got was don't mention it's a dream.
Right.
I mean, in that one, it's plain because it says I slept and woke. So it suggests that actually, you know, and there's another one in there about about Star Trek and the blob.
That's great. Yeah.
When I woke again, it was, you know, it was Late Night Snooker, the one played by dogs. So it's that kind of, you know, what are we, where are we in these poems, I guess? And I think the trick with dreams is not to say they're dreams, it's just to mm-hmm. write them straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think readers will go with it because their imaginations are often used to being in that kind of
right
other space, you know.
I mean, it's fascinating because some of your material comes from dreams, and then others are in my slice of life category, my amateur effort at looking at poetry. And you have some great ones like Closing Time Part 2, which is, you know, I think we've all been to this kind of pub, which is just, it's pretty grim, it seems.
Yeah.
And you're almost telling it like it is, you know, and instantly as a reader you're thinking, yep, I know exactly what he means. You know, thank you for explaining it and showing it so well. Another one, which is quite funny, is the mouth ulcer. The accident that you might have if you're using a toothbrush and you manage to sort of jam into your gum or whatever, because you're not, you know, thinking about what you're doing. And again, that just absolutely hits the spot, and you think, yeah, I've done that. Ow, painful. And you really riff on that until it's sort of bringing up things like, oh, your wife now is going through your texts because you didn't kiss her quite as well as you should have, you know, because, you know, yeah, there's pain in your mouth, and now she's wondering why. I mean, that's great, that type of thing.
I mean, that's great. I mean, you know, the mouth ulcer is a funny poem. I've kind of, again, I think that was a case of having a mouth ulcer.
Yeah.
And then actually, you know, the man at the bus stop was something I actually saw. that's not from a dream. There was this guy in his 70s just sitting there with no top on.
Yeah.
And it wasn't summer. It was, you know, it was kind of maybe early spring, playing a radio really loudly. So there's these bits where, you know, some of all the things that seem surreal are actually perhaps more real than the bits that feel familiar, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay.
So it's quite odd what in there is taken from life and what isn't. I mean, I wouldn't call the poems autobiographical. Mm. I kind of play with that. So, you know, with something like Notes Towards Being an Adult, you know, that's a kind of play on biography, you know, there's kind of playing with kind of hyperbole and all the other, you know, the kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? The sort of hagiographic kind of details that, you know, become in biography. But those things really seem insignificant. So, you know, it's kind of attempts in that to have fun and play with what's real and what's not real. You know?
Yeah, well, that was very effective. Just the last poem to talk about, Carol. Mm-hmm. There's a character, 17-year-old boy, who may or may not be autobiographical, is trying to write a poem about moths and lampposts. And I was thinking, well, this is interesting. And then I wanted to know, did you know that you wanted to write poetry at 17, or how does it sort of hit you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really taking the mickey out of myself and right. the teenage boys, really, in just the fumbled embarrassment and awfulness of being a teenager, really.
Yeah,
you know, the sense that your hormones are sizzling, but you don't know what to do or where to go and
yeah.
where to kind of, you know, you haven't got quite enough money to have the freedom, etc. I was writing then. I was in a really bad indie band. You know, we all had hair down. I had hair, and we all had hair down from over our shoulders, and probably thought we were Ned's Atomic Dustbin. You know, to our shame. So so it's kind of interesting. I think a lot of that is autobiographical, but in the sense of that ability to talk about the past in the present tense of the mm-hmm. past, but as an adult in the future, this kind of really strange thing you can do in narrative.
Yeah, very clever.
But it was certainly I was trying to write poems about moths and lampposts then, you know, as if it was some sort of mysterious thing. And oddly, that crosses with the poem Those Dark Arms, you know, about the cottage hospital. Because there was one, it's down in Tunbridge in Kent, you know, in the A21, was somewhere where we would just, you know, as kids, we'd just wander around as teenagers into fields. We're too big for playgrounds and not old enough to kind of go to bars. So you end up in this kind of weird hinterland of kind of edgeland fields, you know, next to kind of cottage hospitals and the rest of it. You know, I mean, maybe it's just me, but that certainly was my experience of being 17. And
it's funny. There's a lot of juxtapositions of the very sort of straightforward, almost banal, and then the surreal, and it's all mixed together. And then there's the humour. It's very entertaining. I mean, it's opened the door wide open now. For me to go and look at some more poetry, and I think I'll have a better idea of what to look for, actually. I think the way I dipped in, I read it front to back, I read it back to front, found things I liked, and I'm sure, and it will obviously reward another reading. So, I mean, it's been great to talk to you about it. I mean, congratulations again on your debut. It was hugely enjoyable.
Thanks, Mark. I really, really enjoyed talking about it. You know, it's a great opportunity to actually reflect on it and think about what it is, you know, because it still feels very new. And I think every time I talk about it, I'm discovering things and realising connections I just didn't see before.
So that's quite an amazing thing. Brilliant. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Mark.
In the next episode, I'll be talking with Andy about his reaction to the publication of the Somnambulist Cookbook and what he's writing next.